From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Authorities have paused, for now, the difficult work of recovering bodies from that warehouse in Oakland, California, that was gutted by fire on Friday night because the building is unstable. Dozens of bodies have already been found in the building, which had been used illegally as both a living and entertainment space, with artist studios, a warren of apartments, a concert venue, even mobile homes inside the building. Devin Katayama is the Oakland reporter for KQED in San Francisco, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. And Devin, what is going on at the scene right now?
At the scene right now, as you mentioned, they have paused their work. They think that they know the origin of the fire. It's in the back of the building. They think that they know this because there's significant charring. But as you mentioned, they did have to stop their work earlier today because it was unsafe. They've been talking about removing some of this debris bucket by bucket, doing this just really arduous work, partly because they just want to, you know, respect the scene and humanely remove the victims. They've made that very clear in every announcement that they've made. So I think that's where they are right now.
When you say they might know the location of the start of the fire, we had reports of eyewitnesses inside the building saying they thought they saw it start in one particular living space. But do they know why?
They don't know why, and they've made it very clear that it's still under investigation. Until they get to that area, I don't think they're going to be making any sort of this could take a long time to really get to the bottom of why.
Well, many people are still waiting for news of friends and loved ones. Just a terrible scene there outside the warehouse of people looking for missing people on Friday night. Here's Daniel Vega looking for his brother.
I think I'm just more infuriated that I'm not able to help. I want to be there. Give me some gloves. I got work shoes. I'm ready. Let me find my brother.
Oh, Devin, it's just terrible. What are people saying?
It's more of that. I mean, it's interesting in Oakland that a lot of people knew somebody who knows somebody who was in this building. It's a big, you know, this kind of thing exists in Oakland. These warehouse events, they're known. And in fact, a lot of people feel like these kinds of spaces give Oakland a lot of its character. There's going to be a lot of questions into whether this kind of space is unsafe for sure, but how the city deals with these spaces going forward, I think, is going to be coming out.
Well, also, we know there's a criminal investigation going on as to how it got to this point. I mean, people knew about it. There were complaints to the city about this warehouse, and complaints even from people who lived in the warehouse about the way it was kept up. So it's one of the questions: how were people allowed to live there?
And just to be clear, the Alameda County District Attorney has launched its criminal investigation team, has activated its criminal investigation team. So there's no official investigation. But people were able to live there because, you know, as one council member put it to me, the city has neglected some of its duties into these spaces. And I think that's because there's been this culture of acceptance with warehouses like this. And again, I think that's something that the city really needs to figure out, because when you talk to the city, they talk about safety being the number one priority. When you talk to the folks who live there, some of the artists who have been in these spaces, they say that these are the only spaces where they can do what they do. And in many cases, these are the only places where they can live. In a city like Oakland, that's gentrifying, warehousing costs are going up. So I think that's kind of the gray area where these places have existed.
Right there next to San Francisco, where rents are impossible. Well, we have another piece of sound. I mean, these are heartbreaking. This is Kim Gregory looking for her daughter, Michaela, the mom saying that she heard her daughter was going to her boyfriend's house, and then this. Let's listen.
Just sitting on the sofa watching the news, and I got a phone call from one of her girlfriends asking if my daughter was home, and I said, no, why? She said she went to that party last night, the one in Oakland, and she just started crying.
Devin Katayama, it sounds like this is happening all across Oakland. We hear there were a lot of 17-year-olds in that building.
Well, actually, only one confirmed 17-year-old at this point. There was, when they first announced this, they said that obviously they're still looking for more bodies and they do expect more victims. I wouldn't be surprised if there are some more underage individuals, but at this point, we really don't know.
Yeah. Devin Katayama, Oakland reporter for KQED in San Francisco, as the search of the warehouse that the people who live there called the Ghost Ship, which is pretty chilling to hear today, as that search has been paused because the building is unstable. And, of course, they're concerned about the lives of the firefighters now. Devin, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, Italy's prime minister says he will resign after his referendum on constitutional reform suffered a resounding defeat at the polls yesterday. Matteo Renzi had staked his political reputation on the referendum, and its defeat leaves Italy facing political and economic uncertainty. For more, we're joined from Rome by NPR senior European correspondent Silvia Poggioli. Silvia, first, just remind us what Italians were voting on and why did these reforms fail?
Well, the reforms were aimed at basically streamlining the parliamentary system, reducing the power of the Senate, which was basically doubling the work of the Chamber of Deputies, the lower chamber, and also reducing some of the powers of the region, bringing them more to the central government. These were aimed at creating a more sort of stable economic system. The government also said that they would probably also stimulate the economy somewhat by accelerating the legislative process. The fact is that these are very technical issues, and the way the campaign was waged and the way the prime minister mistakenly at the start sort of personalized it, saying if the no vote wins, I'm going to step down, that really transformed the whole referendum campaign into a vote of confidence into Renzi himself. And, you know, Italy, like the rest of many European countries and also the United States, is undergoing a very strong sort of, you know, anti-establishment wave. There's a very bleak economic picture here, and there's a lot of blaming the government. Renzi had come into power just 2.5 years ago on an anti-establishment kind of platform, and he was basically bested by other populist movements to, you can't even say to the left or the right, because it's coming from all sides. And he was defeated.
Is it clear that he is going to actually be allowed to resign by the president?
Well, he already met for an hour today with the president. He's going to, we understand he's going to go back in a few hours, and we expect that he's going to hand in his resignation. The question is, there are certain very important commitments the government has in the next few weeks. One is to pass the next year's budget, and also there's need for a serious reform of the current electoral law, because given how this result went, there's still a Senate and there's a Chamber of Deputies. The current law would not work for a variety of reasons. So he may be sort of pressured to sort of remain in office for a certain amount of weeks, few months. It's not clear. Or the president could decide to create a caretaker government, choosing an institutional figure, the head of the Senate, for instance, to run the country for a few months and then hold early elections. Everything is open. It'll probably take several days before we know exactly what is going to happen in the next few months.
Silvia, leading up to this vote, a lot of analysts said that there was much at stake for Italy politically, but also for Europe in general. What happens now, or what might the ripples be because of this?
Well, had the yes vote succeeded, Italy basically would have not been a problem for the rest of Europe. 2017 is going to be a really major and important year. There are going to be elections in the Netherlands, in France, and in Germany, and particularly in the Netherlands and France, there's some very strong populist, anti-establishment, anti-EU, Eurosceptic parties that are doing very well. Also in Germany, Chancellor Merkel is under pressure for her migration policies and so forth. So Italy, if won yes, it would not be a problem. Now Italy adds to that sort of sense of instability that's going on in Europe. Europe has some very major issues, economic problems it has to resolve, migration, of course, and yet it's going to face paralysis because of these four countries now with major election issues and uncertainty in coming months.
Have we seen any economic fallout yet?
Well, as soon as the results were known, the euro did drop quite a lot. The markets were shaky, but then after a few hours, things seems to have come back to normal. That is not seen as an immediate problem. Even the Italian banking sector, which is very fragile, the first indications today were it's not so bad. But in the long term, we don't know. As I said, it depends a lot of what kind of a government we're going to see, and how many powers it will have, really. If it's just a caretaker government, will it have the political clout to take major decisions?
The vote in Italy, of course, was not the only one yesterday that you were covering. There is another vote in Austria where the former head of the leftist Green Party defeated a far-right candidate in a very closely watched election there. How do these two things fit together?
Well, not really, because everybody was voting on different issues. However, seen from outside, they were both seen as the next steps in this sort of new populist anti-establishment wave, which started with the Brexit vote in June in Britain, and then, of course, Donald Trump's victory in the United States, and then the rising popularity of the National Front, Le Pen's party, Marine Le Pen's party in France, and other sort of movements throughout Europe. So the defeat, let's say, of the hard right presidential candidate who would have been the most far right elected president in Europe since World War II, that was a little bit of a break on this populist wave.
That's Silvia Poggioli, NPR senior European correspondent, joining us from Rome. Silvia, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Over the weekend, Russian President Vladimir Putin called Donald Trump a clever man and a statesman. More praise from Putin for Trump, who has expressed admiration for the Russian leader numerous times. That is concerning to former world chess champion Garry Kasparov, a Russian pro-democracy leader who chairs the Human Rights Foundation. He's the author of the book Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped, which is just out in paperback. Garry Kasparov, welcome.
Thanks for inviting me.
And I know that you have concerns about Donald Trump's admiration for Vladimir Putin, which we will get to. But you've also compared Trump to Putin. Why is that? How are they alike?
Again, it'll take time actually to judge Donald Trump as a president. But from what we heard during the campaign and from what we can learn from his biography, I mean, didn't give me much comfort because he acted more like an oligarch, somebody who just, you know, believed that he would be above the law and he could, you know, break all the rules. And he showed very little respect to the existing democratic institutions. And I think also psychologically, Putin probably felt the same way because Trump showed no respect for institutions that secured European peace and prosperity over the last 6 decades.
Although we just heard from the British Prime Minister that they talked and that Trump had said he respects NATO and he thinks it's important. What do you make of what's happened since the election and how he's picked people for his cabinet, et cetera? And do you have any hope that his foreign policy will be more in favor of some of the international institutions that have been so key to American foreign policy for so long?
It will be a disaster if Trump doesn't change his rhetorics and he tries to stick with his promises to continue the retreat that has started under Obama. During the last 8 years, the reputation of the U.S. presidency and U.S. as a global power has dwindled. And America needs now just to recover its place in the world. And I don't want to sort of prejudge, you know, the American future foreign policy because Donald Trump has yet to pick up his Secretary of State.
Right.
I would be very happy if Mitt Romney is appointed because he definitely has, you know, balanced view of the world. And 4 years ago, he was correct stating that Russia under Vladimir Putin was American number one geopolitical foe.
But Donald Trump does not believe that Russia is the number one geopolitical foe. That's for sure.
I don't think Donald Trump believes in anything, you know, regarding foreign policy or other geopolitical issues. It's so far, you know, away from his world. But now Trump has to make, I mean, decisions that will, you know, define his presidency. And my concern is that he might be restricted by some kind of deals in the past that he made with Russian oligarchs or some other connections that he could have entered with Russians in the years before he decided to run.
What do you what do you mean by he might be restricted?
Look, you know, we know that Donald Trump was on the verge of bankruptcy in 2008, and his real estate empire was saved by a great infusion, a massive infusion of foreign capital. Now the question is, what percentage of this capital was Russian? whether there were some, you know, strings attached. Again, we don't know. I mean, this is for me the biggest problem, that Donald Trump won the elections. He's a president elect without revealing how much he's worth. You know, what is the value of his empire? What are his connections with Russians, maybe Chinese and other foreign investors? So we know very little about the man who is just about to assume the most powerful position in the world.
How do you explain Putin's public admiration for Trump? Why has he been so seemingly happy and welcoming of the new president?
Okay, there's the two possibilities. One is actually three. One is that he might have something tangible on Trump. I think it's unlikely, but again, I wouldn't exclude it completely. And he believes that Trump will be, as I said, restricted in his actions. Second, I think is most likely is Putin liked what he saw in Trump. He's a KGB guy, and he proved to be a very good savvy operator while negotiating with the foreign leader. He totally outplayed George W. Bush, who also, you know, admired Putin at the beginning of their relations. So I think Putin believed, whether he believes it or not now, I don't know, that Trump could help him to create more chaos globally. All Trump statements about NATO and about traditional American alliances, it was like music for Putin's ears, because Putin needs a weaker Europe, divided Europe. And if America decides to withdraw completely, that will help Putin to continue his aggressive foreign policy.
Do you think that Putin had anything to do with the Russian propaganda machine that was behind the effort to spread fake news articles on social media leading up to the election that were usually negative toward Hillary Clinton?
Oh, by the way, anything that happens in Russia, you know, it cannot happen without Putin's direct approval. Anti-American propaganda for years is a core of Putin's domestic agenda. And attacking Hillary Clinton, I mean, that for Putin was kind of a compensation for what he believed, you know, was a betrayal of Obama's administration. Putin thought that policy of reset meant that he could do whatever he wanted in the post-Soviet territories and also globally. And the fact is that America eventually showed some teeth, you know, made Putin quite upset. And there's no doubt that the operation to discredit Hillary Clinton and to hack the DNC server and to go after some of the Hillary Clinton's closest advisors like John Podesta, it was all sanctioned by Putin and was a part of the KGB operation to influence American elections, because it also helped Putin to boost his image as a strong man who could even meddle with U.S. elections.
So, Garry Kasparov, what would your advice be to Trump, if he will listen to you, about how to deal with Vladimir Putin on issues like the hacking, but also in Syria and in Ukraine and elsewhere?
Now, first of all, I hope that Trump administration and the Republican senators and members of the House will not block investigation of Russian hacking and Russian interference into American political system. I think it's very important to restore the confidence that American political system is intact and no foreign power, especially hostile foreign power, can influence it. Then, of course, you know, you have to look at the record of Vladimir Putin. I mean, not to listen to what he's saying or he's writing, because for him, as a KGB agent, the words is just, you know, it's kind of a wall to cover his true intentions. And the fact is that Russia today is, as Romney said 4 years ago, is a number one geopolitical foe that is attacking strategic American interests and is attacking the free world everywhere. You need a comprehensive policy, not just, you know, tactical cooperation or a tactical confrontation, but a long-term strategy to make sure that NATO will get together. I actually agree with Trump that, you know, the American allies in Europe will have to boost their defense spending and to create, you know, a modern defense system that will guarantee the security in Europe. And also it's globally, because Russia and Vladimir Putin will poke America and the free world anywhere where they can find the soft spot.
You wrote an article in The Washington Post back in July, right around the time of the Republican National Convention, that ended with, quote, "The moral, be careful whom you vote for. It could be the last election you ever have." Do you think that, given what's happened in the election and how Trump has acted afterwards, that do you still believe that in this country?
No, obviously, there is a threat with someone like Trump that American political system could be compromised. But I believe in the strength of American political institutions. And so far, I could see that Trump, you know, is relying heavily on traditional Republican deal makers and politicians. So it's highly unlikely that he will go too far. But at the same time, you know, I'm troubled by his continuous tweeting on every issue that goes under his skin. And also his statements that, you know, might be considered as an attack of the First Amendment, they're also not adding confidence. Still, you know, I think American political system is strong enough. And it's very important for Democrats actually to get their act together and to start, you know, presenting, you know, a viable alternative for the future.
Gary Kasparov, before we let you go, we have to ask you about chess for a moment because something pretty extraordinary happened. The Norwegian defending champion Magnus Carlsen and the Russian challenger Sergei Karjakin were locked in a tie at the World Chess Championship. Carlsen ended up winning in a series of high-speed tie-break games. What did you think of all that?
Yeah, you're right. It was extraordinary that the match lasted for so long because Magnus was a heavy favorite. I spent a year working with him in 2009, 2010, and I can tell you that it's absolutely unique talent. Sergei Karjakin, okay, he won the qualification, but it was kind of an accident. And it was, you know, sort of a high-tension drama at the last moment. But I think the game of chess eventually has won.
That's Gary Kasparov, who is the chairman of the Human Rights Foundation. He is a former world chess champion. And his book is called Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped. It's just out in paperback. Gary Kasparov, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
A pivot from the headlines now for a look at guitars. They're made from some of the rarest woods on earth, woods found in places hit hard by deforestation. U.S. guitar makers are starting to look elsewhere and one day hope to shop in the Pacific Northwest. Ken Christensen from Here and Now contributor Earthfix reports.
Steve McMinn walks into the hollow of an old maple tree, reaches for a piece of wood, and breaks it off.
If you look at it right here, see that ripple there? And I'll always just feel with my finger. It tells you some stuff your eyes can't.
When McMinn looks at trees, he tries to see their future.
It's difficult to predict unless you look under the bark.
For decades, he has supplied the guitar industry with wood grown from Alaska to Oregon. Nearby, at his sawmill in the North Cascades, he turns giant logs into thin sheets of wood and ships them to America's biggest guitar makers. Sometimes an employee picks up a finished product, and you can hear the strumming over the constant buzz of the mill.
I figured somebody could do a better job providing wood for musical instruments than had been done.
But lately, McMinn has been looking further into the future, trying to help make the guitar industry more environmentally friendly. Many guitars are made from rare trees like rosewood, mahogany, and ebony. They're popular for their sound and their beautiful appearance. They're also popular among poachers. It's a problem in the Northwest, where maples have been illegally harvested, and in hardwood rainforests, from South America to Madagascar.
It's increasingly difficult to legally, ethically source wood from the tropics.
So guitar makers are looking for new sources of wood. And one place they're looking is McMinn's backyard. The Pacific Northwest is home to the big leaf maple tree.
Maple is a clean, green, legal, local wood. We're interested in seeing whether we can provide them with a secure supply for the long term.
Big leaf maples are common in the region, but very few of them develop the kind of beautiful wood grain that guitar makers want, the kind with ripples that you can only see when you look under the bark. So McMinn teamed up with Jim Mattson.
Is it too much stuff here?
Mattson studies trees at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. In his office, he shows me a dozen wooden artifacts that he keeps on his shelf.
When we think of wood, we mostly think of wood that looks something like this, with a fairly straight grain. But it's also quite dull in its appearance, so many people like trees that are defective.
By defective, he means trees with grain that isn't straight. Grain that has a wavy pattern or looks like tiger stripes or...
something that looks like bubbles on the surface.
It's called figured grain, and it develops in many types of trees. But nobody has figured out how to grow maple trees to look like this.
You find it very rarely in nature, and we don't know what the cause is of that.
But Mattson had a hunch. In other kinds of trees, the wavy grain is genetic. So he began taking samples of figured maple trees and cloning them in his lab. Right now, they're small enough to grow in baby food jars. When they get bigger, Mattson and McMinn will turn 50 acres of farmland into a figured maple plantation. It could take at least 10 years before the trees reveal whether or not they've developed the wavy grain. McMinn is willing to wait.
Left to my own, I would rather just have trees, period.
If McMinn doesn't see guitars in their future, at least he'll have trees to look at. For Here and Now, I'm Ken Christensen in Seattle.
There's been a lot of talk about Donald Trump's controversial phone conversation with the leader of Taiwan. But in India, there's also concern about Trump's recent phone call with the Pakistani prime minister. According to a Pakistani account, Trump was effusive, calling the Pakistani leader a terrific guy. Meanwhile, Trump's organization has a number of building projects underway in India, more than any country outside North America. Joining us now is the BBC's Rahul Tandon. He's in Kolkata. And Rahul, how would you describe the reaction in India to Donald Trump's presidential victory?
Well, I suppose we, if you look at what was happening during the campaign itself, India's quite an insular country when it comes to foreign news, but as he's done in the States, as he's done across the world, really, Donald Trump did get people talking here. On the one hand, you had people from the right-wing Hindu Nationalist Party who were holding special prayers, basically. They were so desperate that he was going to win the election, or wanted him to win the election. On the other side, the Clintons were pretty popular here. Bill Clinton had quite an affinity, as did Hillary Clinton here. So you had small villages in parts of India that had big Clinton posters up as well. So quite a scene that we haven't really seen during a presidential camp before. And of course, since he's come to power, the debate is, what will Trump mean for India? You know, on the one hand, I think there is a sense here that he could take tougher action with Pakistan, though people were slightly surprised about his phone call with the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. On the other hand, I think concern about outsourcing to India. Of course, he's been tweeting about that in the last 24 hours. And also what it could mean for visas for Indian software engineers who wants to stay. So I think everybody's trying to digest what Trump means to India with lots of differing views, lots of differing hopes and expectations.
Well, let's listen to some of the people you spoke with in Kolkata about Trump's win.
I think he's good for India. He stopped giving aid to Pakistan. Maybe he would pass the bill in the House which says that Pakistan is a terrorist state.
I don't think so, not at all. Especially the way he behaves with the ladies. So we don't want him here either.
He says that he loves India and he's in support of India. But his words really don't mean anything because they change over time. So you can't just trust that guy.
After Trump comes into action, he will actually stop the funding into Pakistan, which I believe is a very important step towards the development of India, because you know we all know how the tensions which keeps growing up in the border area.
He mentioned the border area there at the end. You talked about that phone call that Donald Trump had with the Pakistani prime minister. We saw the readout of that call, which looked like Trump was saying some very nice things to the Pakistani prime minister. How has that gone over in India?
I think there's been surprise, really. It wasn't a phone call that they expected he would make, and that if he did make it, he might have taken a little bit tougher stand with India's neighbor, of course, who they've had a number of wars with, and still the dispute over the territory of Kashmir. Because if you look back at Trump's previous record, he had been on record as saying that, you know, the U.S. is not friends with Pakistan. But I think people here are going to wait and see, really, because they saw some of the rhetoric from Trump during the campaign. He's also probably just feeling his way into office. is. I think a lot's going to depend on his Secretary of State choice and the impact that's going to have on foreign policy and the direction that he's going to go with there. And I think still deep down the Indians would feel that he is more likely to be friendly to them. If he was, though, to interfere in something like the Kashmir dispute, I think that would lead to a very difficult relationship with India because the military situation is really heating up between both countries.
You know, you mentioned the Hindu Nationalist Party. I wonder how much of Trump's popularity in India has to do with an anti-Muslim sentiment.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I think that is completely the reason why the Hindu Nationalist Party's really supported him, particularly some of the fringe elements. And again, I think they would have been surprised by his sudden friendliness with the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. But I think there is a hope that within that section of the Indian population that he will take a tough stance on what they define as Islamic terrorism. And that he's going to do something about it. That is his sort of rhetoric during the campaign struck a chord with Hindu nationalists here, of course, who are a very strong political force at this moment.
Rahul, one of the photos that came out right after Trump was elected was a picture of him in Trump Tower with a couple of Indian businessmen. Now, as we mentioned, Trump has a lot of projects underway in India at the moment. Tell us about some of his projects in India.
Well, of course, you know, this is a market, isn't it, where property is developing very quickly. He's looking at a huge complex in Mumbai. But I think Indians find Trump difficult to understand because he's a businessman. He sees the potential of one of the worst growing economies. On the other hand, he seems to be sort of companies don't do so much business with India, don't outsource there, don't employ Indians. So they see a contradiction with Trump that they're going to wait and see how that plays out. They like Trump, the businessman. But will they like Trump, the president, with his economic policies?
That's the BBC's Rahul Tandon joining us from Kolkata in India. Rahul, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, will the president-elect's finances raise questions about the fate of the Dakota Access oil pipeline? Yesterday, Native Americans and environmentalists celebrated that decision from the Army Corps of Engineers to seek alternative routes for the nearly complete project, a review that would block the pipeline's construction for months or years and ultimately redirect it from the planned route a half mile from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. This was a huge victory for the protesters and a major blow to Energy Transfer Partners, the company behind the project. But will a Trump administration reverse the Army Corps? Donald Trump has supported Energy Transfer's plan. The New York Times reports that he owns stock in the company. The Washington Post reports he's sold it, but Trump has said any financial ties have nothing to do with his support. NPR's Nathan Rott is there at the Ocheti-Sakowin camp in North Dakota, where protesters are still camping out. And Nathan, what a turn of events. The protesters were told they needed to evacuate the site, then this announcement. The Standing Rock tribal chairman said the Army Corps decision means they don't have to stay there through the brutal winter. But is that still the thinking? Are they staying?
From everybody that I've talked to, yes. I know that the tribal chairman had said that, but I've talked to other people with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe who have been at the heart of this protest. I've talked to some of the thousands of veterans that are here, some of the environmental groups that are here, and the consensus that I've got from them is that this is not over. They are planning to stay here, dig in, and be here through the winter.
Well, so the Army Corps of Engineer has said that they're going to look for an alternative site. Now, there was an alternative route north of Bismarck, North Dakota. That was considered and rejected previously. So what are the other options?
You know, that's something that a lot of people are asking. There's other places that they could look to put this pipeline. Obviously, that would have to go through an environmental review. The pipeline says, too, that they already went through this process to get the pipeline approved where it is planned to go now, which would be across the Missouri River at the place that people have been protesting and the place that has obviously been stopped as of yesterday. If the pipeline is not approved, though, one of the things that people need to remember is this oil is still going to be moved. The pipeline would move oil from the Bakken in North Dakota, the oil fields that have exploded in recent years, a little less recently with the decrease in oil prices, and it would take it to Illinois where it would be sent to other places. Without that pipeline, the oil is probably going to get sent by freight cars, rail. And anybody that covers that industry and can objectively say, though, that rail car is a far more accident prone to transport right. oil than pipeline.
Right. So we'll keep an eye on that. But meanwhile, supporters of the plan are calling the decision not to execute it overreach. Representative Kevin Cramer, the Republican from North Dakota, says it's a chilling signal for those who want to build infrastructure. And I can't wait for the adults to take over on January 21st. He's referring to President-elect Donald Trump and his team. So can Donald Trump reverse the Army Corps decision on January 20th?
That's a question a lot of people are asking, and frankly, I don't know the answer to that. That's something that I've been digging into today, calling some environmental lawyers, some people that know this whole realm a lot better than I do. I mean, the sense that I've got from talking to people here that have been following this, that are invested in this, that have been camping at this encampment for months on end, is that Trump will do everything he possibly can to see this pipeline through. And so people here are preparing for that. They think that that is ultimately what's going to happen.
Well, meantime, just in the few seconds we have, Nathan, there's also controversy as to whether or not Donald Trump still owns stock in the company. But putting that aside, what is the mood there? They are going into a brutal winter. I know they've been building yachts and things. What's the sense of how tough this is going to be?
It was funny. Last night there was fireworks going off in celebration of the announcement, and at the same time people were digging in. There was construction going on, people building new shelters, expanding the camp. I mean, people are excited here. It's snowing really, really hard right now, so yeah. I think people are kind of hunkering down. But yeah, we'll just wait and see.
NPR's Nathan Rott in North Dakota. Nathan, thank you.
Thank you.
The debate over fake news has taken a disturbing turn. Edgar Madison Welch of North Carolina was arrested yesterday after he walked into the Comet Ping Pong Pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C., carrying an assault rifle. He fired at least one shot, according to police. No injuries were reported. He told police he came to, quote, self-investigate an election conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton and Democratic operatives had been using the pizza place as part of an underage prostitution ring. There is no evidence of that. D.C. police have called it a fictitious online conspiracy theory. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
And this theory about Pizzagate has been spread by fringe websites, but it's also been pushed on Twitter by the son of the incoming National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn. How do these false stories get so believed that someone ends up going to the restaurant with a gun?
Well, what's happening, I think, Jeremy, is that these pieces of fake news, propaganda, outrage, whatever you want to call them, they aren't being pushed by traditional broadcasters like the New York Times or CNN, but they're still being pushed by enormously influential broadcasters. Alt-right websites with tens of millions of readers, Twitter accounts with hundreds of thousands of followers. These are not traditional broadcasters, but they are large, and that's how these fringe ideas are getting into the mainstream. And there's a word that I keep coming back to when I think about these stories. It comes from the world of artworks and auctions. It's provenance. You know, you're selling an Italian Renaissance painting. People ask, where did it come from? You're selling a Persian rug. They say, what's the provenance? Where did this come from? But what we have right now, which is rather disturbing, is an environment where people, including the President of the United States, Donald Trump, seem to not care the provenance, to care about the provenance of these pieces of information. They are taking news from places that are not being careful about where they're getting their news from, or they're deliberately lying and pushing them into the mainstream. And it is getting, as you said, literally dangerous for some people.
But you would think that the market would help decide this, that basically once people were burned by one source that they realized it wasn't true what they had read, that they wouldn't go back to that, and the traditional or the reputable news sources mm-hmm. would rise to the top. What can people do to make sure that they're getting their news from reputable sources, given how many news sources there are?
Well, the first thing to say, Jeremy, is that obviously, of course, what we would wish is that everybody cares about quality news. But unfortunately, I think what a lot of people go to the news for is confirmation bias. They just want to know that their side is right, that the other side is wrong, and whether or not the piece of news is true, whatever its provenance, they just want to believe what they already believed. So how do we get to an area of broader non-political media literacy? The first step, I think, is ignoring propaganda, identifying the propagandists, identifying the websites and sources that you cannot believe and not paying attention to them. The second step, I think, is identifying our own biases, understanding what we believe and disbelieve, and saying, Do I believe this article because it upholds my priors, because it upholds my biases, or do I believe it because it is making a contained and beautiful case for its own argument? But this is incredibly difficult to do, and it's especially hard to do, I think, when you're a young person just being deluged with so much stuff on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and everything else.
Well, when you're talking about young people, I wonder if it's almost time for a media literacy class to be included in a school, because we are in a very different media environment, and we never kind of train people to, understand what's a reputable news site and what's not, and not be fooled by these things.
That's exactly right. Now, there was an article recently in U.S. News & World Report by Cedar Springs High School teacher Dave Stewart. His solutions looked a lot like mine. He said there's three things you have to do. Number one, identify credible sources. Number two, question sources that come from outside that list. And number three, become an expert in vetting stuff that you read and even vetting your own opinions. His class at the high school now has an article of the week exercise where students bring in an article and discuss it, what parts are true, what parts are not. This is a fabulous idea, but this is truly not exclusively a high school experience or a high school experiment. This is something that people have to do throughout their life, an ongoing education in establishing the veracity of the news that they read.
On the other hand, that I'm sure sounds very political to some, to have the teacher saying these are the sites you should read.
Of course, right. No, that's exactly right. And this is why it's so impossible to have, one God voice to say these are the sites that are good and these are the sites that are bad. You would look at a place like PolitiFact, which was established a few years ago to essentially separate truth from fiction throughout the sort of news ecosystem. But very quickly, you had conservatives saying PolitiFact is biased because it says the Republicans are lying more than Democrats. And you even had some liberals saying PolitiFact is biased because it uses false equivalency to not essentially blame some conservatives as much as they deserve to be blamed for lying. So It is inevitable that any organization that tries to find balance will inevitably be politicized. And this is why it falls not to the organizational level, but to the individual level for us to become our own expert vetters for the news that we read.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. We welcome your thoughts at hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.